Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The hidden costs of the long losing war in the Middle East can break your heart when you learn the disproportionate deaths of innocents. They could break the bank when the credit card debt on $6 trillion worth of war comes due. We are getting highlights this hour from a remarkable network of auditors, so to speak, on the dangerous downside of empire. About 24 independent scholars of history, economics, and warfare are linked in a cost of war project to tell us what the government would like us to ignore, starting with the point that our wars since 9/11 have been financed by borrowing. The main reason that our national debt exceeds now our gross national product, meaning we owe more than we produce in a year. Just the interest paid on this credit card war era is more than $1 trillion. Distinguished scholars in the mix, in the studio tonight, Nita Crawford of Boston University. I'd like you to lead the way. You've done prize-winning work for decades now on war, sanctions, collateral damage, moral beliefs, theories of peace, and you're co-director of this Cost of War project based at Brown University, and you chair political science at Boston University. Speak of the new urgency about the price we're paying, the price we barely know.
Well, if you think about it, over the last almost 18, 19 years. Now we've been spending money on an adventure that was meant to make us safer. And what we've got here then is basically a set of consequences that were probably unanticipated. When we started, we were told by Mitch Daniels in 2002 that the Iraq war would cost about $50 billion. Mm. And now you can see that we're well beyond that. That's about the budget, the average for each year of spending in these wars. But let's think about it in terms of the big sort of baskets of consequences. First, please, as I've mentioned, is the federal budget. And then there's a second basket is the larger economic consequences that fall from spending so much money on war. And then the third basket of consequences is obviously the human toll, what it's cost in lives who are killed and injured and displaced by these wars. The third big set of consequences is strategic. The fourth big set of consequences is strategic, and that is the way that these wars have affected the United States' position in the world. And then finally, there's this unanticipated sort of crept up on us consequence, which is the wars have really hurt us in terms of climate change, the tremendous greenhouse gas emissions that are associated with both the use of force in these war zones over such a long period of time and the fact that these machines we use are gas guzzlers, but also because we've been bombing oil wells now and they've been blown up in Iraq and Syria. And that has led to not just oil spills, but a lot of burning of oil, which has gone on for months. So we could start with the federal budget, if you'd like.
I'd love you to start with the human consequences.
Okay,
over
sure.
There, here, on equality, on inequality, but on men, women, children, impoverishment, gains, what?
Okay, so I think the big number, the big thing to keep in mind is about 800,000 people have been killed directly by violence.
I know. We mourn 7,000 or so military personnel, 800,000 and some direct and indirect deaths.
No, just direct deaths. That's direct
deaths out
violence.
Of the war.
Right.
Wow.
And then so indirect deaths are those deaths that are caused when infrastructure is damaged or destroyed. So a lot of infrastructure damage occurred in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and certainly in Syria, where they've deliberately bombed hospitals. And so when you destroy infrastructure, there's a sort of long-term tail of consequences for health and well-being. And then in addition to that, you've got – you mentioned the 7,000 U.S. soldiers, but we've got survivors, that is people, 50,000 or so, 52,000 people who have been wounded in these wars. enough so that they're counted as wounded. And then there are the soft tissue damage and other things which don't count as wounds, but which are nevertheless life-changing for many people, as well as other musculoskeletal problems, traumatic brain injuries, and so on. Then we've got about 2,000 people who've had traumatic amputations, which means they've lost a major limb. Then think about the civilians in these war zones. So about 43,000 or so Afghan civilians have been killed. Maybe as many as 200,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. Then you add to that the deaths in Syria, which no one knows for sure, but it's several hundred thousand. And just in the after the United States joined, of course, the war's intensified, and there are about 40 to 50,000 deaths in Syria since the U.S. joined in 2014.
On our own people, you know, what do you take to be the trickle-down effects on health, on, God knows, our morale is not what it ought to be, our sense of our future, our reputation, maybe even our character? What's going on with us?
Well, only about 1% of Americans actually serve in the armed forces, but the consequences for our society are tremendous. I mean, the care of the veterans needs to go on for decades afterwards, and much of the care of veterans who are injured, who need a lot of care, let's say they have traumatic brain injury or PTSD or have lost limbs, will increase over time as other things sort of they get comorbidities, it's called, you know, having multiple things go wrong with them. And that care is often passed on to the families. The men and the women who are married to them or who are their parents have to care for them. And then there's also the problem that there's a tremendous rate of suicide. There have been more suicides among active duty soldiers than there have been deaths in the war zones few years.
I read that. Is that the number that's hidden, in a sense, in the 7,000 or so military deaths?
No.
How many of those are suicides?
No, that's a whole other category. So the 7,000 deaths we're talking about in the war zones, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, are people who were killed in the war zones and the other 80 to 90 countries that the U.S. is active in, who died as they were killed in action or they died as a result of their wounds. And then the same thing with the injuries that I'm talking about. Those are in the war zones. So they could be injured.
I'm asking you about that haunting.
But the suicides is a whole other category of people. There are thousands of them. We don't have good numbers on that.
Wow. I mean, part of the story here is that almost every discussion that you hear from even the newspapers and from politicians buries the lead, so to speak, of, you know, progress is being made or whatever the euphemism of the day is, or I'm more against it than you are against it and whatnot, the human cost, but the number, which begins to look threatening to the republic, threatening to our survival. How does this happen, that we simply can't seem to talk about it?
Talk about the number of deaths?
Well, talk about the costs of war, human and financial.
Well, because the war's over there and we're not paying for it right away. And I think Professor Belmas would be good to explain how we're not paying for it right away. But I think it's sort of deferred. It is that small number of people who are actually in active service, the 1% or so.
Let me introduce Linda Belmas, teaches public policy at Harvard. And with the Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz, she co-wrote The $3 Trillion War About Iraq. That was 10 years ago. Your work, Linda, in progress, as I get it, is the ghost budget. So the price has doubled in a decade. What is the ghost budget, and how does it get appropriated?
Well, let me start by saying that this has been our longest and most expensive war in U.S. history. So we now have young people who are serving in Afghanistan who were not born when we invaded Afghanistan. There are dozens of young men and women over there. And we have spent close to $6 trillion in terms of the cost of this effort. And it's such a huge number that it's really hard to fathom how big that is. One of the reasons
almost
is
impossible.
Because in English, million, billion, and trillion rhyme. And yet there's a big order of magnitude difference.
If 1,000 at every jump, right.
It is. I mean, if I count to a billion every second, that would take me 32 years. If I count to a trillion, that's 32,000 years. There's a big difference. And so it's almost unfathomable how much we've spent. And so what we've been trying to figure out is how is it possible? How is it possible that this country has embarked on something where we've spent this much money and yet it is basically not talked about and we're not feeling it? So the ghost budget concept refers to the literary idea of the ghost as being something that is visible but not tangible. Like these wars, we know that we're spending a lot of money, but we don't feel it. We don't feel it because we're not fighting. Most of us, only a tiny percentage of the population is serving. For the rest of us, there is no conscription, and we're not paying for the wars because...
Whose idea was that, by the way? We've got to deal with this credit card war notion.
I mean, I've coined the phrase the credit card wars because one of the aspects of the ghost budget, which refers to both the budgeting for the war and the financing of the wars, is the fact that we have not yet... Most of the money for the wars has been borrowed, and this is a very different... very profoundly different war financing strategy than any previous war in U.S. history.
Who is buying the bonds that pay
that? Well, I mean, this is public debt, so a lot of it is Americans paying for it, but it's also a significant portion of our debt is international. We're in a global capital market now. And one of the things that
is... Are people investing in this war, so to speak?
I think what is reasonable to say is that unlike previous wars, we have had particularly since 2008, we've had historically low interest rates and a global so-called flight to safety. So you have the whole world essentially buying and financing U.S. paper, commercial paper, that is paying for these wars.
We've got to talk about that. And why other wars were financed differently. The United States had the highest debt-to-GDP ratio during World War II, and yet we'll hear Harry Truman raise taxes to pay for the Korean War and ended his presidency with a budget surplus. Stand by. Coming up, the cautions to warrior nations from ancient history up to our own President Eisenhower in his 10-minute farewell address almost six decades ago. This is Open Source. The broad lines of argument around our military budgets got laid down by a victorious general who'd become a popular president in the 1950s, Dwight D. Eisenhower's last speech from the White House, 3 days before John Kennedy's inauguration, was a blunt warning.
We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That was Eisenhower's best-remembered speech, but the question is who in a position to act was moved by it, moved to action. Even JFK, who knew war, longed for peace, and stumbled straight into the Bay of Pigs and eventually into the American War in Vietnam. I want to call on you, Rosella Capella Zielinski. Your big book 4 years ago was How to Pay for War, lessons, unbelievably, from 200 years of war financing in the wide world. You, too, teach political science at Boston University. What is it we're not getting here from warnings like Eisenhower's?
Sure. Thanks for having me in this conversation. I think the first thing we need to think about when you asked, Linda, how we get into this borrowing to pay for war rut is that political elites want to shield the public from the cost of war. And this is deliberate.
From the cost or from the knowledge of the cost?
Both. the financial cost and the public opinion cost. They want to be insulated from the public opinion. One of my favorite quotes during the Vietnam War is we have Secretary of State Dean Rusk saying the administration made a deliberate decision not to create a war psychology in the United States. They say there's been no war bond campaigns. The decision was made because it was too dangerous for this country really to get worked up. And this has been deliberate for multiple administrations. And we can see this regardless of party and partisanship in these forever wars, all being paid for by taxation and business as usual. Right. We have after 9/11, President George W. Bush encourages families to go to Disney World. In 2003, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay states nothing is more important in the face of war than cutting taxes. We have tax cuts throughout this war with the Obama administrations and Trump administrations. So we need to remember that this is deliberate by politicians. And I'd like to take the moment to remind people, if we go back a little further in history, it doesn't need to be this way.
That's desperately fascinating. Three presidents all delivered tax cuts in wartime. Tell us how Truman did it differently.
Yeah. So that's unheard of. So Truman is this wonderful model of raising taxes. So the war, Korean War begins. He's in the midst of cutting taxes. Cutting taxes was quite popular at the time. And he says, as soon as the war begins, we are going to pay for this war as we go. We are going to raise taxes. And the population, American citizens, support this. There are various Gallup poll surveys during this period, and people are saying, I want to be taxed more. 70% of respondents in one stated they were willing to pay more money in taxes to support a larger army. 70%. And it works. Truman ends 1950 with a budget surplus. And in fiscal year 51, reduces gross federal debt. Could you imagine reducing debt in a war? And so this, I'd like to stress upon American citizens that there is precedent in the past for this. And we can raise taxes. And it's really important because we're not just talking about, you know, mortgaging the U.S. for these wars. There are these other distributive consequences on inequality in the United States that these forever wars.
Explain that connection from war to inequality.
Absolutely. So borrowing to pay for, particularly when combined with the tax cuts, can promote economic inequality. Borrowing benefits those who can afford to invest. So ignoring the 30% of U.S. debt held abroad, 70% held in about 70% in the United States, are those who can afford to have these portfolios and these retirement portfolios. So those who are able to purchase that war debt, we're going to recover their investment with their money back. But the future burden of debt servicing, paying it back, falls on the entire tax base. So those who can't afford to hold U.S. government debt in their investment portfolio, low and middle income households eventually are bearing this burden of paying off government debt via their taxes. And that's going to transfer wealth from the lower middle income classes into these high income households.
Rosella, I want to introduce your colleague at Boston University. Shamiran Maiko has written about her native Iraq under occupation, dictatorship, and democratization. Her next book will deal with different outcomes of the Arab Spring of 2011 and years after. Would you explain the Iraq case? It was a financial restructuring project before it was a war. Bill Clinton signed the, Iraq Rescue Act or something, and the war, in effect, delivered it, a basic shall we say, neoliberal contraction of public space, privatize, monetize, and of course it was already militarized. How did this happen, given the history?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I think one of the things that we often forget, or the American public forgets, is that America has been at war with Iraq since at least the 1980s. The United States, to both an indirect and directly.
1980s, they were
in
the
Iraq War.
But we were on their side, so to speak.
We were on their side, and we financed and supported the Saddam Hussein regime against the Iranian regime. Now, fast forward to 1990, you have the Gulf War, and the Gulf War, where Iraq invades Kuwait, then the United States takes the lead in the international coalition to kick Iraq out of Kuwait. But essentially, in many ways, actually, that becomes a watershed moment, just like the 2003 war becomes a watershed moment for American long-term American engagement in Iraq. Then we enter the sanctions era. The sanctions era was more or less administered by the UN, led by the United States, where Iraq was placed under pretty extensive and comprehensive sanctions for 11 or 12 years. Now, that sanctions era in the 1990s completely devastated Iraqi infrastructure capacity. And so we're talking about, you know, things like delivering of food and medicine. It's an estimated about 300,000 Iraqi children died under the sanctions era as a result of malnutrition and the absence of medicine. And that takes us into 2002 and the war planning. Now, in 1998, Bill Clinton signs the Iraq Liberation Act, lobbied by neoconservatives in their alliance.
Remind me, what did they have in mind? And why were we going to Iraq to restructure their economy at that point? Under our sometime ally, famously pictured in a laugh-it-up scene with Donald Rumsfeld. Why were we doing that in the first place? What is the economic thrust of all of this activity?
Yeah, so the sanctions era essentially also, in many ways, caps the infrastructure capacity of the Iraqi state to produce oil. The sanctions regime essentially prevents the state from importing new technology to increase oil productions. As Nita had mentioned earlier, there's targeted destruction of different Iraqi oil infrastructure.
And to what end?
Well, in the first Gulf War, one way to limit and prohibit state capacity in Iraq and to really kind of prevent the regime, the Saddam Hussein regime, from becoming a bigger belligerent state than it had been and by invading Kuwait was to basically cap the actual economic production of the state. And so the targeting of oil wells and Iraq's oil infrastructure. Now, Iraq is a rentier state. 90% of its budget comes from the sale of oil. And so the state itself is actually quite reliant on the sale and export of oil. Mm. It's the fifth largest oil producing state in the world. And so the idea was that you would basically cap the regime by targeting its largest oil sector. And so in terms of environmental destruction and warfare, that really has its own kind of, you know, there's a whole history to that that continues post 2003. But that was the logic, was that once you targeted the actual economic base of the regime, then you could in many ways decapitate the regime, and that would create internal instability. And so in 1998, Bill Clinton, at the behest of neoconservatives and Iraqis in exile who were working with the neoconservatives, lobbied the Clinton administration to pass the Iraq Liberation Act. And what that does is essentially advocates for regime change. So it was no longer about pressuring the regime to change its ways. It was about actually removing the regime.
Shamran, connect this to the forever war. It's been going on one way or the other since the 80s, as you said. But the first decade, the notorious 80s war, was our support of Iraq against Iran. Saddam Hussein eventually crossed the wrong line when he invaded Kuwait. But what is the principle? What is the, you know, looking back 50 years from now, what will we say was going on? Or was it just plain throwing our weight around?
Well, there's a strategic logic to it. At the time, the Iranian Revolution had just happened in 1979. The Iran-Iraq
Wars contain the Shia Revolution.
Contain the Shia Revolution and contain the threat there. That was the kind of the logic, that you would support the Saddam Hussein dictatorship in its war, in his war effort against Iran. The Iraq War happens in 1980, and it goes on until 1988, the longest conventionally fought war of the 20th century.
Right. And oh, by the way, Iraq has a Shia majority, and now it's really strategically in the hands of Iran.
Yep.
The great enemy.
Yep.
Does anybody know what's going on? I mean, does anybody debate these fundamental questions?
Well, I think the questions are multifaceted, just
of
as
course,
the causes of war are multifaceted. And oftentimes, I think what gets lost in translation, going back to the cost of war, was that in the neoliberal state-building project that was envisioned in post-2003, the idea was that you would have a thriving economy by privatizing the oil-producing sector, by, you know, promoting deregulation, and then essentially allowing American oil companies and foreign oil companies to extract Iraqi oil and build built Iraqi oil capacity. Now, if we look at Iraq since 2003 to now, it is not in a better place in terms of its social and economic development. In fact, it's actually stagnated. It's stagnated if we compare its development now in comparison to, let's say, the 1970s and even the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq war. It's nowhere near where it used to be.
How does the restructured Iraq work after occupation compared to the bad old days under Saddam Hussein?
So I'll say one of the things that we saw with the Iraq war post-2003 was this emphasis on what some people call the fifth branch of the military, which was the reliance on contractors. I think the latest figures was the 138 contractors made about $138 billion off of the war. These are reconstruction contractors, these are logistic contractors, and of course, military contractors. There's also a lot of money that's lost in a war that kind of gets unaccounted for. $12 billion in cash went missing, cash that was flown from New York to Baghdad. 365 tons of $100 bills went missing and have been unaccounted for because nobody was actually there controlling for the spending of
money. I can see the stacks of them on sort of forklift carriers. Nita Crawford, does this make any sense in the larger picture of permanent war, or is the folly, the arrogance, the ignorance that took us into Iraq tell the story?
Well, the whole idea was that the United States would be there in Iraq for a few weeks. This was the briefing that President Bush got, and they said it's going to be quick. We'll start the reconstruction phase in a few weeks, and we'll be out. And then mission accomplished.
And we'll be showered with candy and flowers.
Right. And so we're told it's going to be quick. It will be effective at getting rid of weapons of mass destruction. Of course, there weren't any to get rid of. And we're also told that it would be precise, that civilians wouldn't be harmed, and that there'd be few American casualties. We were told that it'd be good for our economy and that oil would be cheap. There's little chance for escalation. And that we're going to be more secure. None of those things obtained. And the problem was we went in with the wrong kinds of expectations about the effectiveness of war. And this isn't the only time we've done it. War is almost always never quick, effective, controllable, not
Was it good for cheap? Anybody other than the Halliburton Corporation, Cheney's old...
3,000, more than 3,000 contractors were also killed. So those would have been U.S. soldiers if they had not been contractors who were killed. But yes, people made money.
That's another mystery. Huge deficits, debt coming out of these wars, and yet billions of dollars in corporate profits. How do we square that? Including our own beloved Raytheon, McDonnell Douglas, these folk.
I think one of the reasons that this has been able to go on for so long and that all of these things have happened is the way that we've paid for these wars. So the wars were paid for 10 years through what's called emergency supplemental funding, which is unlike any other war. No other war in U.S. history has been paid for basically forever through this kind of money. And the whole idea of emergency money is that it's for actual emergencies like hurricanes. So you want to get it out very quickly and ask no questions. It's just fast. So there's almost no oversight. And we, for 10 years, were shoveling huge amounts of money through this emergency mechanism, which became a giant Pentagon slush fund. And there was no real incentive in the Bush administration to change this, because if they changed it, that would be essentially a tacit admission that things were not going as well and things were not as rosy as it seemed. There was also, because of the structure of this enables you to essentially minimize the deficits going forward, even because the money is all in the rearview mirror. And Obama, when he was a candidate, was an enormous critic of this. But when he was elected president, he wasn't able to take this on because it was such a powerful slush fund at that point. So he tweaked it slightly so that there was now a budget, an institutionalized second Pentagon war budget called the OCO budget, which is exempt from the sequester and all of the caps and PAYGO limits. So it has become another kind of slush fund, because as the Pentagon has been under pressure from the sequester, they're now paying for a lot of the base budget through the OCO budget. So we now have the perverse situation that almost 20 years on, even though we have far fewer troops and weapons and equipment, and even as we're pulling back, in theory, on the ground war, we're still spending the same amount of money. We're still spending 10% on top of the Pentagon budget
Linda
every
Billmas,
year.
Let me ask, where is the incentive in partisan politics, in Congress, in journalism, in academia, to blow the whistle on this incredible fraud?
I mean, there is no incentive, and this is the problem. There are a few people who are talking about it, but the interests are aligned. You have a dysfunctional Congress that barely manages ever to enact a budget and essentially exists on continuing resolutions, a Pentagon that is very ferociously trying to maintain the kind of spending that it sees has been impaired by the sequestration on its base budget, and a successive number of administrations that have just seen this as an incredibly convenient way to keep shoveling money towards the wars, toward the interests that are aligned in this way.
In other words, President Eisenhower understated the case of this incredible monstrosity that was coming together in private and public hands, the corporate war industry and the Congress.
That's right. In fact, in his last version of his military-industrial complex speech, he was calling it the military-industrial congressional complex, and he edited Congress out at the very last minute, but at this point I would put it back in.
Linda Billmas, stand by. Coming up, all the folk wisdom we ignore. Everybody's heard the line that Afghanistan is the place that empires go to die, and there we are. Also, that what great military powers die of in the end is bankruptcy. This is Open Source. Tulsi Gabbard is the warrior for peace in the Democratic presidential nominating contest. She's Hawaii's representative in Congress, still an active major in the Hawaii National Guard with battle stripes in the Iraq War. From the primary campaign trail in New Hampshire this week, she spoke with us by phone about the cost of war, coming home from Afghanistan, a $2 trillion American war since 9/11.
You know, the cost of war is obviously something very real for those like me who have served in these combat zones and these war zones, where every day we've been confronted with the terribly high human cost of war. We often have veterans who are coming to our town halls, and we share these conversations of our experiences, both of our brothers and sisters in uniform who have been killed in combat, those who have been injured, who come home with visible and invisible wounds,
right,
as well as the high human cost that takes place for the people in the countries where we wage these wars. And really, for those who are joining our conversations, whether it's at town halls or across the country, who may not have that direct experience of serving in the military, really we speak about the cost that the studies like those coming from Brown University really show. This is translated in a very real way when you break down the fact that in Afghanistan today, we are spending $4 billion every month, which is $5.5 million an hour just in Afghanistan alone. So we're talking with
right.
teachers who, you know, they need paraprofessionals in their classrooms. They need special education teachers. They need mental health counselors in their schools. They look at, wait a second, we're spending $5.5 million per hour in Afghanistan, but we don't have enough to take care of our kids who really need help here at home. What's wrong with this picture?
The Pentagon's own inquest into this 18-year war in Afghanistan concludes it was a mistake from the conception.
Yes.
And the politicians knew it. The generals knew it every minute.
Over three administrations now, and this is what is both so heartbreaking and angering all at the same time, is that through the last three administrations, we have senior leaders in our own government, both civilian and military, like you said, who knew that this was a waste.
You're hearing it from soldiers, families, wounded, which is probably the way to get the news, but it's also, speak of it as a political issue. You can talk about anti-imperialism as a right-wing cause, as a left-wing cause. George McGovern, Come Home America, but in 1972. And Tucker Carlson says it, I think, directly to President Trump. How do those two angles converge?
Every single day here in New Hampshire, we have Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians who are coming together, recognizing, hey, we may agree to disagree on maybe a few issues or maybe many issues, but this issue about ending America's imperialistic foreign policy, ending regime change wars, working to end the new Cold War and nuclear arms race, and redirecting our taxpayer dollars here at home is an issue that actually unites the vast majority of Americans across party lines.
You know, the great President General Eisenhower warned us about all of this in his farewell address in 1960. The military-industrial complex would consume us, he said. You're there. You're in the belly of the beast still.
Yes.
Where's the military-industrial complex in this 2020 campaign? And would you know it when you saw it?
Yes, Chris. Very good question. And you're
Thank
right.
You.
The military-industrial complex is alive and well in Washington and continuing to exert great influence over our political leaders. You only need to look to the huge amounts of money that are contributed to some of our top leaders in Congress across both parties who have direct influence over the defense spending decisions that are made.
But let me ask, where is it in this campaign? Can you look at one of those rival candidates and say, you're talking the line of the defense contracting industry?
You can see this across a number of candidates. I'm not going to name names. I think it's clear if you listen to the kind of rhetoric being used by the different candidates running for president. And
Help out the voter who's got to make a choice.
I encourage voters to pose those questions as they'll see these candidates coming through New Hampshire about what kind of commander-in-chief they'll be, whether or not they'll bring our troops home from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Syria, and whether they will once and for all end these regime change wars.
Congressman Gabbard, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope to talk to you again.
Rosella Capelli-Zielinski, pull on those threads, two of them particularly, the domestic damage in our own country to not only the veterans, but families, communities, but then also the matter of alternative ways we could have spent that money. That, to me, is the easiest way to imagine what $5-6 trillion means, is what it could have done here and now with us.
Oh, I could think of tons of ways.
Give us three.
Student debt, health care, climate change. But I think the conversation needs to bring back around to actually just pay for these wars first outright moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I was really pleased in 2019 when then candidate Beto O'Rourke started this conversation and proposed a war veterans tax and pushed Congress to enact a law creating a trust fund for veterans health care for every war the U.S. fights. And each fund would be paired with a war tax on a progressive basis. And I would like to partially use this money to pay for our veterans and to make sure that they're receiving the care that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where we need to, of the many things we could spend it on, let's start with it first taking care of those directly affected and go from there.
Dita Crawford, what did you gather from Tulsi?
Well, a lot of things. I think she's right that there's a reluctance to really talk in detail about these wars. It's in part because many of the candidates are implicated in voting for them and supporting them, even if they didn't vote in the original resolution, and they haven't worked out a way to pay for them. That's very tricky once we've gone so far into debt. But I want to go back to this question of what else could we have done? And we're always told that military spending is good for the economy, and it actually isn't as good for the economy as we think. Sure, some people make out really well, but if you spent that same amount of money, you'd get more jobs doing other things. You'd get more jobs in healthcare, in infrastructure, in energy, in education.
In a Green New Deal, perhaps.
Certainly. You get, for military spending, you get 7 jobs per $1 million. If you spent that same money in a Green New Deal, you'd get 10 jobs. If you spent that same money doing public education, you'd get nearly 20 jobs.
Shyamaran, we haven't dealt enough with the Afghanistan papers. Came out of the Pentagon confessing a gigantic deceit over 18 years and $2 trillion. What could we do about it? It was a great story, as everybody says, for 2-3 days, and the news cycle resumes. How do we learn that lesson for real?
One of the things that often gets lost in the shuffle, and I think this is something that Tulsi Gabbard had alluded to, was the fact that not enough people, the American public doesn't talk enough about the cost of war and its implications. And so the Afghan papers come out, you know, there's a big news segment that's done on it for a couple of days, and then it's kind of forgotten. But what the Afghan papers show us is there's a consistent pattern of generals, you know, people who have been serving in Afghanistan for over 10 years, you know, nearly 18 years now, who have been saying the war wasn't working. And I think there's almost a disconnect between what was happening on the ground and what the generals knew and what the what our elected officials knew and what wasn't told to the American people. And so if we think about even this in strategic terms, the strategic value, right, of what all of this means, if we think about, does this make Americans safer here and there? What is the actual human cost of these wars on people there? You know, but, I mean, she talked about visible and invisible wounds. Those visible and invisible wounds are multiplied, you know, by the tenfold when we think about their impact on Afghanis and Iraqis.
Yes.
Right.
I want to push back on the notion that the American people don't know, don't understand this problem. I think the American people are scared out of their wits that we're going down the drain for these absurd wars, that we are literally in danger, you know, in the foreseeable future of a kind of bankruptcy. Bankruptcy of reputation, bankruptcy of finance when these bills come to be paid. I always remember asking the historian Simon Schama, Englishman, how do these empires end? And he said, bankruptcy applied to maybe the Ottomans, but certainly the Brits and maybe the Romans eventually. I mean, we know intuitively, we're not stupid, that you can't go on like this, shooting up the world at enormous cost and get away with it. I mean, when does that, how does that surface? How do we get it to surface?
Well,
Linda Bilmes.
Well, I'm not sure that people do really think that much about the wars right now. And certainly the latest polls that I've seen
show they think of it in various forms. They think of it in terms of addiction, opioids, people on the street.
They might.
They know something's amiss.
They do know something's amiss, but 41% of the population in a recent poll said that either we were no longer at war in Afghanistan or they don't know. And if you compare the amount of media attention that is given to the wars in Afghanistan after all of these years, even to the Afghanistan papers, it's minimal compared to the amount given to impeachment and a whole range of other things. Partly because this is difficult, it's complicated, it's hard to capture all of these issues that you are, to your credit, trying to capture today. But I think that people do know that the number is high. What people don't really understand is that all of this money has been borrowed and has just been transferred to the next generation. People don't really understand that we have essentially spent trillions, we have borrowed trillions of dollars, and what we have bought with that borrowing is this giant hole in the sand.
But I think we look at our kids and grandkids and we are shocked. We are ashamed of ourselves.
We are ashamed, and we know that if you can borrow at virtually 0% interest rate, which is what the government borrowing rate has been since 2008, I mean, we could have provided our country with a strong infrastructure. We could have provided student loan renewal relief. We could have provided universal preschool. We could have provided most of what many of the Democratic candidates are suggesting to some extent. I mean, for the trillions of dollars that have been borrowed. But, I mean, we have lost that opportunity. And the only thing that we have accomplished is that because of the fact that the stimulus after the financial crisis was arguably not big enough. I mean, we have had a kind of backdoor under the table stimulus program through war spending, which, as Nita was just saying, has one of the lowest multipliers in terms of the U.S. economy of any kind of stimulus package we could imagine.
Nita Crawford, I want you to bring it home in a sense. But first of all, are we in danger of bankruptcy?
This is a bankrupt way to run a government. But look, think about where we were in 2000. We were in budget surplus, and we've been in budget deficit ever since, and the debt just keeps growing. It's unsustainable. But this is the way that empires often act. They, you know, think about it. You mentioned Ottoman Empire, but the ancient Romans, the Spanish Empire, the French and the British, and then even the Soviet Union, they overspent, they overextended, they made enemies.
Impoverished their own populations.
And then they paid in blood and treasure beyond what their people, their population, was willing to bear. Now, if by smoke and mirrors we don't see the costs, then we might be able to bear it a little bit longer. But the irony is that the realist worry that if we cut military spending, all hell's going to break loose, the sky will fall. Mm. But actually, if we cut military spending, we would be better positioned to maintain the U.S. position in the world.
Let me ask with great respect, is it sheer chance that most of the drivers in your cost of war project are women, starting with our friend Catherine Lutz at the Watson Institute at Brown? What is that piece of the story, and how you formed, how you work, the way you think?
The Cost of War Project is now about 50 academics at many universities, men and women, of various ages and stages in their career. It just so happens that the original co-directors, Kathy Lutz and I, are women, and that Linda Bilmes is a great economist, and separately doing this work, we brought her in. You see some of the women... Rosella Capella as well is part of the Cost of War Project, but we've always had men and women doing this work in various ages and stages in their academic careers. Mm. And then we've always also included physicians, journalists, anybody who can shed light on what's going on in the many ways that these wars have affected us in the post-9/11 era. Look, the United States is at war in 80 to 90 countries. And right now, Stephanie Savelle, who's also a co-director of the Cost of War Project, is in Burkina Faso looking at the global war on terror.
Rosella, would you add a last word?
Sure. I really want to give some credit here to what Nita's doing with this Cost of War Project. When I was working on this, my book project, I had this great quote, Pentagon Comptroller Robert Anthony, 1967 congressional testimony said, "We do not have a cost accounting set up for the Vietnam conflict. I think you and everyone agrees that one does not set up a cost accounting for war." And it is our responsibility as citizens, as academics, to do that when our government and other states and the government won't. And I am deeply, and we are all should be deeply embedded to the Cost of War Project for what NEET is doing here.
My impression is that the ranks of your workers are growing by leaps and bounds. How about the audience, and what do you see as your role in this 2020 presidential campaign year?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened was when I published a paper on the greenhouse gas emissions of war, a whole environmental community began to pay attention to the costs of war. They hadn't realized, I think, that the Pentagon is one of the world's largest greenhouse gas emitters. If it were a country, its emissions would be the size of Portugal or Sweden or Denmark. And so in that sense, people are making connections to the ways that being at war this long has come to affect our economy and the opportunities we have.
You've been writing since your student days, Nita, about the war system and alternatives to militarism. What is the system that seems to be prevailing against the alternatives?
Well, it's those assumptions that I talked about earlier, that war is effective and that it's efficient and that it works and that it's better than the alternatives. That's the system. It's a system of beliefs. And the alternatives are, frankly, those things like diplomacy and sanctions that are not targeted broadly, but are targeted on the sectors where you can have leverage. And I think that there's a failure of imagination here, actually, to imagine what we could do if instead of assuming that force works everywhere all the time, we could look historically and see that when we apply force, when we surge, people resist, and that force doesn't work. So that's the thing I've been doing the last 40 years. Yes, I've been working on this a long time.
There's a failure of public conversation, too, and we hold ourselves responsible for our piece of that. We would love to have you back. This is an important conversation, obviously, and it's stunning how seriously you can present the urgency of these numbers. Thank you, Nita Crawford, Linda Bilmes, Rosella Capella-Zielinski, and Shamaran Mako. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath runs our Defense Department. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.